First of all, I guess just to sort of open up any, how's everybody doing with the material? We've been through a lot in terms of not only our historical survey but and philosophical survey, but we've sort of really gotten pretty deep into the compassion training. And I think all of us really enjoyed Lo Sang La last week, Dr. Rapke. How is it feeling in terms of practicing with the text, working with the four kinds of or at least now we've touched on the third of the four meditations. Are people feeling riding the wave or feeling a little under the water, or any questions or reflections or discussions we haven't had? We have an opportunity now as a larger group to process. Okay, well, I mean, if no one has any thoughts, I mean, since it's me, you can feel free to raise your hand and we'll try to, when something comes up, or but try to let's try to grapple with the material. I'm sort of go backtrack a little bit today over to review, which is one of the things that we like to do, and it's a very traditional thing to do as well, to be sure that we've heard it all too many times. And also because Lo Sang La touched lightly on the content, so we want to be sure that we are a little more explicit. And maybe the first largest kind of context to set is just to sort of look at where we are on our journey of exploring the mind training. So if I think Roshana, do you have the table to share?
Sure. Let me get a up for you. And you will let me know. Let me know when you see it.
Oh, there we go. All right. Okay. So I don't think anyone, I'm not even sure how, I don't think I can do run the view options here. We can see your cursor. Can everyone see Roshana's cursor? Okay, great. So you see that we looked at the, if you want to put that on the four steps process there, right? So we looked through mindfulness as a preliminary, and then based on the practice of mindfulness, as you remember, wasn't it very nice that Lo Sang talked about the way in which a foundation in mindfulness is necessary to be able to gather the data. If you're going to do the experiment, you need to be able to gather clean data in terms of observing your mind more objectively or more closely. And the way he talked about that as that being the basis for your experiment. And then, when you make the experiment, then the fourth scope would be really, acting on your findings, basically. Like, okay, I find that, anger and rage don't work so well for me. They leave me tired. People get mad at me back, and right. So, or maybe I'm being too nice and I'm too clingy and frightened to assert myself, and I need a little more assertiveness but I'm doing the experiment and I'm finding out how to relate to others by observing my own mind. So it's not just the principles, like the where this all meets the road is in our meditation practice and in our daily lives. We're really checking how's this working for me. And the fourth scope there of mindfulness practice, the insight, mindful insight, is about really being able to start focusing in on the things that are healing and medicinal and realistic or help or like wise, and tuning out or dismantling the things that are harmful, vicious. I'm using that in a kind of technical sense, and unwholesome, as you might have said. And then we're looking at the, so Rashawn, if you go back to the, just point out the four steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, down there, equalizing the costs of self-enclosure, the benefits of wise compassion, and exchanging self for altruism. So where are we as we go into the mind training? We've looked at the preliminaries, which is really about at least being able to be with ourselves well enough to know what's healthy and what's unhealthy, and to make those wise choices. When we can do that, we have a kind of basic self-compassion. And he taught, and that was another very fascinating comment about how, you know, really the traditional way of thinking about self-compassion, at least in the Tibetan tradition, the Nalanda tradition, is that it's really about learning how to let go of what's harmful and act on what's helpful. So it's really thought of as more, you know, we might say renunciation or kindness rather than compassion, self-compassion per se. And then we looked at the relative compassion, which was about really learning how to stop projecting our feelings into others, as Pilar was saying, and to learn how to start meditating on the kindness and giving and taking. So meditating on the kindness is where Losangla's first four cause and effect steps came, is recognizing that we all depend on life and get and have all been given this life and have ourselves cared for and protected by others, and really using that as a basis to start to value the goodness and overcome our feelings of hurt and anger or defensiveness to the extent that we can or that it's wise to do so, and learn how to repair. That is to be able to accept relationships and people as they are and build love and compassion. So that's the second point, the second precept in point 2A, which Pilar helped us with, is contemplating the kindness of all beings, right? So that's where we are. And then we're giving and taking, which is the practice we talked about today, is starting to prepare us to be in dialogue with others in a safe way, or be in close interaction with others. So we looked a little bit last week at the stanzas of ultimate compassion, at the kind of the wisdom themes that we'll go over again today. Right, so don't worry about it if you don't remember that. We're going to go over it, and that's going to then open us to steps 3 through 5, which we're also going to try to do today. So we're going to try to do a lot today, probably too much, but we'll go over it. But I also wanted to just draw your attention to where we are in our practices that we've touched on. We're hopefully all grounded in our mindfulness. So in that, yes, in the third column, if we're looking at skills, which we teach most explicitly in something called the CBRT or compassion-based resilience training, we start with mindfulness. Then we move to equal empathy, the first compassion training, which we did a few weeks of, I think 3 weeks of. Then we move to self-compassion, which is really very closely related to be able to being wise with ourselves. And we'll go into that today. And we just moved to wise give and take, which is where we are now. So we're moving right along there. And in a few weeks, we'll be focusing on emulating mentors and trying to build a bridge to the tantric or embodied practice. So just as orienting ourselves, how far we've come, we're about, you know, in the just closing the second point of the mind training, and looking at the costs of self-enclosure in Chandadeva's method, and then trying to understand how wisdom and compassion work together in self-compassion, how to put on our own oxygen masks. And then we're going to cross the bridge and start looking at building our compassion. Once we can have real compassion for ourselves, then we can really start building it in our interactions with others. And that's where we look at the steps 3 through 5, let's just say. And we look at wise give and take as a practice. And that's corresponding to the third point of Chandadeva's 4 steps. Okay. So let's maybe retire that. Cool. So any questions about that big context, the overview, where we are in our journey? Is it sort of feeling like people have a sense of where we are with the practice, like what the terrain is? Okay, yes, I see some thumbs up. Okay, all right. Well, I'll assume it's some smiles and head shakings. I love it. Okay, thank you. And of course, if anybody doesn't get it or has a kind of, is confused by the way we're laying it out, please do speak up, so we don't want to leave you behind. So let's talk. Maybe now you could bring up, Roshana, the self-analysis, the 4 keys. At some points, we've referred to a practice called the 4 keys. And again, it's super confusing in the Buddhist tradition. They use numbers as a way to organize information. And so there's 4 of this, and there's another 4 of this, and 4 of that, and then there's 7 of this and 7 of that. And you've already had that, so it can become very confusing, but that's, hopefully we get the idea. So what are the 4 keys? So if you want to look at the 2B, the second point in the 7-point mind training, the second half of the second point, again, really confusing, apologies. But the wisdom part, the part that says, meditate on all things as like dreams, look at your, discover the secret of openness, all of these things. We'll go over that then. Really, they're about doing the work of analyzing one's own suffering. So this is like being your own therapist and really understanding what's real. And this is how we learn to stop getting fixated or contracted on our trauma and our traumatic reactivity, and to create the space by facing and examining clearly, how have I been hurt? What is hurting? How am I understanding myself in this process? And the sort of most rigorous practice for doing this is the practice Bob Thurman led us through in that class. So I'm just gonna go through it now, and it's a very analytical, it's a shockingly analytical approach to, mindful insight or insight meditation, I guess you'd have to say. So the first is, of course, the Roman numeral 1. We're going to do this as a real practice, so we need to be sure that we have a situation that's good to practice in. I'm just covering that that's kind of like a preliminary. So we get into our mindfulness. If we have, we have a good context, a supportive environment, a safe supportive environment in which to start to disarm and explore ourselves through mindfulness, then we open the space of mindful awareness that Roshana was taking us into, the clearing in the forest. That's where we're going. And then that's going to become the workspace where we do the work. And here the work, rather than the work of compassion, like relating to others with greater care, or accepting their suffering with greater peace or ease or confidence, now we're going to look at the work of wisdom. What makes compassion real, as Lawson emphasized, is that it really understands the nature of suffering, and it understands not just the nature of suffering, but the causes of suffering that need to be removed. And hence, when we care in that way, we actually can help. And whether it's ourselves or others, we need to understand the causes, and there has to be that wise analysis. So then we look at the four keys, which are one of many, I'm sad to say, or happy, I guess, in another context, you might say, but for the sake of us as newcomers in this, there are many different frameworks to do this work. This is the core work of Buddhist wisdom. This is Buddhist psychoanalysis or Buddhist psychotherapy. How do we really grapple with our suffering? And so here's the most common framework, which comes straight out of Nagarjuna. Remember the one who found the Heart Sutra? And he went to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. And it's interpreted through all of his disciples for centuries, including Chandrakirti, Shantideva, Atisha. We should recognize some of these names. And then there's this format of the four keys, which is actually, it's actually, I think it's a Tibetan format done by Tsongkhapa and other, based on the Atisha tradition. So the first key is that we have to study our traumatized sense of self, right? So here's the prompt. Imagine the last or the worst time you were unfairly targeted or falsely blamed. So in other words, you're under attack. You're trying to remember the last time you felt under attack. Why? Because you want to start to become acquainted with your self-protective sense of self, right? Your self-protective fixation. This particular thing, Cindy, is not in our resources. It will be posted. So you watch yourself in that, you rerun the psychodrama in your mind, and then you turn your attention away from the attacker onto yourself, and you start to examine yourself. What narrative have I reverted to under attack? What emotions are running me under attack? What is my body sense? Where do I feel the stress, and how do I feel the stress in my body? What kind of sensations? What kind of displeasure, and where? And how's my body itself guarded or gripped by stress reflexes and so on? So that's all kind of like just self-inquiry. Now the question is, what's holding, because that's our traumatic self, as I like to call it. That's the way we get when we feel traumatized, when we feel threatened. Now, what's holding that? What's holding our traumatic memories, traumatic narratives, and traumatic reactivities in place? It's the fact that we tend to fixate around that traumatic sense of self or contract around it, right? So if we use Ethan's terminology, it's fixate. If we use Lama Rod's terminology, it's contract. We're just holding on for dear life to that sense of I'm so threatened. And it almost really begins to kind of take on a life of its own, like become very rigidified, very ossified, very set in stone, what I call reified. Meaning it seems to become now a reality unto itself. And again, I would say very sadly, given our negativity bias, this traumatized sense of self not only seems like a reality unto itself, this is really who I am in this situation. This is really what's happening. I am the victim of this attack. But it also, because of our negativity bias, has an oversized influence on our state of mind. And we tend to identify more with this vulnerability than we do with all the good things that happened or all the ways in which we might have been harmful to other people or intimidated other people, right? But this feels more like me. I'm under attack. And that's our negativity bias. So we want to look at how and as part of that fixation, there's a sense that this is not just a temporary kind of aspect or a very relative situation. it feels, if you kind of do this experiment, when you get into this state of mind, like, this is me. This is the heart of me I'm protecting here, okay? And that me that I'm protecting feels very solid, very fixed, doesn't depend so much on situations. It really seems absolute in a way, that is to say, non-relative. It doesn't seem like, you know, this is only in this context that this is me. In other contexts, there's another me. It doesn't feel that way. It feels like this is the real me. This is the only me. This is always me. At least in my experiments, you got to do yours and figure out if this applies to you, okay? So then we get to the next thing. All right, we've got the problem in mind. And they say you should do this first step for 6 months, okay? Like, this is serious. And this is kind of like a psychotherapy, understanding how we feel traumatized. And it's also true for those of you who know in the 12 steps, when you look at your inventory, what you're doing in your inventory, which is a critical step of self-inquiry, is you're looking at how you've been hurt and how you harbor resentments or how you harbor coping strategies or defenses based on how you've been hurt. So this is, you know, so that's what we study for months. Then we move on to, what am I going to do about it? Well, the first thing I'm going to do about it is I'm going to try to figure out, is this really who I am? What's the basis of this? Is it true? Is it real? Is this something I should now hang my hat on? Okay. And we're doing that in part to help us find out whether we're holding on to something that is distorted, false, and hence, unnecessarily distressing, or we're holding on to something that really is true and has a basis in reality and therefore has to be dealt with. So, I mean, obviously the experience is real, but is the sense of how real it is the sense of its reality exaggerated? Has our fixation on it or contraction around it made it seem more real than it really is? And how would we examine that? So here's the cue there. They say the way you should understand the second step is like this. Imagine that you were you just fallen asleep in your apartment or home, whatever, and you suddenly felt a tarantula brushing across your face, and you woke up in a start, but you didn't know whether it was a real tarantula or whether you had a nightmare. So there you are in the middle of the night in your home, and you don't know whether there's a poisonous spider there with you, or whether, in fact, you just had a nightmare, okay? So that's the question here is, what is the sort of epistemological status or the truth status of this sense that I am this victimized, embattled, traumatized, small, maybe flawed person? What's the truth status of that? And essentially what we're doing in this step is we're committing to really look into it. We're committing to really look rigorously and fearlessly until we get to the bottom of it. And we essentially, in terms of the metaphor, we find out whether there's a tarantula in the house or not, whether I really am that, okay? Rebecca, good, please just let me sort of close out the simple discussion of this, and then please ask your question. So, the idea is we want to get to the point where if we don't find the tarantula, we know it's a nightmare and we can go back to sleep, right? We just want to go back to sleep. Like, if we find the tarantula, obviously we need to get it out of the house. but if we don't find it, we need to be able to rest and accept the outcome. So yeah, Rebecca.
Thanks. Yeah, no, this is great. And I've been like grappling with this question of, this sense of similar to what we've been talking about over several weeks, like around what it means to have self-compassion and self-esteem and that kind of thing, and being sort of like well-balanced and integrated vis-a-vis sort of setting appropriate boundaries in cases where there are, you know, perhaps real threats. And I think that in Buddhism, even this sense of like integrity that we sometimes feel is healthy, in Buddhism, in deeper sort of levels of Buddhism, is also sort of questioned, or isn't, not questioned, but like is still to be unpacked. And so like where the line is, I think is confusing to me. So that's the question.
Yeah, no, this is like, this should not be feel simple to anyone. This is not simple and it's not obvious. It's extremely counterintuitive. It's probably the most counterintuitive thing ever to question your sense of yourself, right? And especially when we know that we are not, you know, invulnerable fortresses. We are super, as Bob likes to say, we're highly evolved wimps, you know? So we have no fangs and no claws. And of course, even if we did, there's also the power of the systemic forces of violence, people, having elaborate systems of racial oppression, gender oppression, social control, patriarchy, all of the kind of normal, human sources of violence. We're not just talking about a saber-toothed tiger here. Like this humans, predictable sources of violence. And so, it does and should feel scary or odd or strange to be examining this strong sense of self that's this coming to our own defense, grabbing hold of ourselves and putting a stake in the ground. That instinct seems like our life depends on it. And it seems like the realest thing in our lives. And essentially, what this tradition is saying is actually that instinct is actually not your best defense. And it isn't what it seems. Why? Because when we're protecting ourselves in that way, we are also disabling ourselves. We're locking ourselves into a certain posture of defensiveness that's designed to fight off physical predators and does not give us access to our best defenses, which is our capacity to think clearly, negotiate and assert and communicate ourselves effectively. I mean, it can, but very often when we get triggered reflexively or without conscious quality control into self-protective instincts, we're not thinking very clearly and we're acting on instinct. And we often don't do the most skillful or effective thing. We often don't have access to our ability to stay confident and know our power. So that's really the challenge is, from a Buddhist point of view, there's the philosophy of it, which is what the heck are they talking about? Why are they asking us to look at whether we have a real self or not, or what the, so that's one question. But the more pragmatic question is this healthy? Is this questioning yourself healthy, or is it making yourself vulnerable? And do we need to hold on to the sense of self-protectiveness in order to feel secure and safe in the world? And this is it's an experiment, like Lozong was saying. Don't take it from the Buddha. Don't take it from me. Don't take it from Lozong. Don't take it from the tradition. Do the experiment. Ask yourself, when I feel threatened, how do I react? And does it help me be skillful and effective and helpful? Or does it just immobilize me, lock me into a limiting posture that exhausts me? Do the experiment. Don't. This is not up to be bought on faith. It's not a premise. It's not a dogma. it's an experiential insight into the way the Buddha's mind worked, and then, you know, it's been replicated, and other people, some other people agree. Well, you don't have to agree. So that's the idea, is to just essentially ask, how real is this sense, or how is the sense that I have to protect this sense of me, how is it really helpful, right? So how real is it, and how really helpful is it? And those are the kinds of questions that we're trying to get, and we're just going to examine them. And we have to be open to, if I discover that, you know, in fact, there is something for me to hold on to in this very, very realistic way, then maybe that's reality. I just have to accept it, that I am, this lone bit of matter in a hostile world, and I better look out for number one. But that's, they're saying, that's actually not the best defense. In fact, Gelug Rinpoche always used to say, compassion is the best defense. Why? Because no one of us is really powerful enough to protect ourselves for very long in many or most situations. We need other people. Our power lies in our ability to connect. And once we're in stress mode, we lose to some extent that ability. And we lose to some extent the higher faculties that give us real power. So that's the premise, it's up to you to decide whether it's true or not. So if we move on to the third, so the examining the mind and body thoroughly. So this very traditional way of saying it is, supposing there really is a part of us that is so me, that is so separate from everything else, so unrelated to anything else, so independent of anything else, that it feels, it is actually in reality as isolated and as fixed and real as it feels. Supposing there is such a reality inside of us somewhere, okay? So if there's gonna be that thing, which is like our tarantula, right? If there's a real fixed me, and I'm just protecting it, then I should be able to find that somewhere. And if I live in a room with in an apartment with two rooms, then I've only got two places to look. Okay, so in this view, in this simple way of analyzing the mind and body, they say there's two ways of looking at it. One is looking at the parts or the things that make up the human life. That is the five systems, our physical body, and then the four mental systems: sensitivity, emotion or motivation, perception, conceptuality. I think that's five. So either we're going to find that real me, like the barcode of me, right, in those parts, somewhere inside there, or we're going to find it somewhere else that's apart from the parts, somewhere like the whole is bigger than the parts, or there's a spiritual essence of me or a soul me floating around somewhere that's where I'll find that real basis. So this is just a kind of a particular grid. It's you know, in a sense, arbitrary, or it's binary. But that's common sense. If I have a two-room apartment, I'm going to look in one room first, and then if I don't find it there, I'm going to look in the other room. And if I don't find it in either room, then I know it was a nightmare. Okay? So that's the idea. So we first look through the mind and body, and this is where Bob took us through. We go through your physical body, and you look at all the elements and the cells and the molecules. And my introduction to this was when I was in medical school going to histology class, and seeing the electron micrographs of all the cells in the human body that look like some kind of weird architectural conceptual art. And it certainly was very clear to me that there was no Joe in there, you know, in any of those cells. There wasn't even a human in there in any of the cells, nothing recognizably human. And so that's the kind of examination that we're asking. Like, we're holding on to our body as if it's me, but where? Where is it? Where is that me that we hold on to as if it's such a solid point fixture? Then we look through our emotions, which are always changing and which are multiple, not unitary. We look through our concepts, which clearly are not just our own. We share a lot of words and opinions and even memories and experiences with other people. We look through our sensitivity, which we share with all living things from a Buddhist point of view. All living beings, including amoebas, don't want to suffer. Then they want happiness or pleasure, whatever it is to them. And so that's not unique to me. That there's no particular barcode there that says this is Joe's sensitivity. And then we look through motivations, and motivations, again, our emotions. We have a natural set of emotions. I think I maybe I missed something or whatever, but you see the point. You look through the parts and you keep looking to see if there's anything in there that is non-relational, right? That is, in other words, as independent, fixed, unchanging as my sense of me feels when I feel threatened. And when we don't, that we know we have a cognitive dissonance. I feel very really that I am being victimized in this situation and that I have to protect myself from everything or everyone or whoever is threatening me or however I feel threatened. And yet, what if I realized actually, that was a deceptive appearance and that in fact, I wasn't just this body or I wasn't so, you know, something I could grab a physical hold on, and I actually was able to, stay more with a more spacious sense of openness to the experience, even though it's extremely unpleasant, and step back and size up my options for coping with the situation before I get all fixated and contracted around my sense of victimization and trauma. Right, so that's the, so we're looking here through the mind-body systems. And if you do the experiment, the prediction here is you do it on your own. You look carefully, you're not going to find something that is independent, that is as independent, fixed, separate, unrelated, identifiable as you think. And there's many other ways of helping to kind of shake us out of this sense of fixity. These are really just kind of defixing or decontracting reflections. And then finally, we look to the fourth, behind door number two. We look behind door number one, we didn't see the tarantula. Now we look behind door number two and we see, well, if I take my bodily feelings, my body experience, if I take my emotions or motivations, if I take my discursive or symbolic process, if I take my perceptions, if I take my sensitivity and I put them all over there, is there a real me now? Is there something that's really me, some essence or spirit or soul or whatever that is really me, that likewise I can grab a hold on and I need to grab hold of and protect myself with? And of course it turns out, well, how would that really be me when it doesn't look like me, feel like me, act like me, think like me? How me could it be if it's so removed from all the things that make me who or what I am, right? So again, this may feel like a very kind of artificial or arbitrary kind of way of examining, but it is just a way of getting us to look, it's a systematic way of getting us to look very carefully at our experience, basically, right? And to try to see our way through this, the sense of exaggerated, the deceptive sense of I know exactly what's happening here and I know exactly what to do. So supposing that that's clear, is that clear? I mean, that is not going to be, I mean, I'm sure that raises a lot more questions than it answers. Roseanne? How does one do 2, 3, and 4? How long? Okay.
The first one was 6 months, you said.
Yeah, so there it's as long as it takes. And in my personal experience, like I discovered this practice, Bob it led me through this practice when I was 20, and I'm a long way from 20, and I'm still doing it. So the idea here is really, it's a kind of way of relating to oneself. It's a way of gradually increasing our ability to take space from our primal, you know, defenses or traumatic reactions and experiences. And it is, in my experience, a very slow process. And you could do a retreat on it, and sort of get a little bit of a head start, and then build it into your practice, because this isn't kind of this isn't normal mindfulness. This isn't McMindfulness, okay? And so, A, you have to understand the rationale. Look, just to talk in Western psychology terms, we want to practice self-compassion. What limits our ability to have self-compassion? Well, A, our ability to actually generate caring feelings and direct them toward ourselves. But B is our internal sense, if you want to call it low self-esteem or whatever, it's our internal sense of being flawed or bad or wrong, these core shame beliefs. And in my experience as a therapist, this is like somebody said, people, we all live lives of quiet desperation, G.K. Chesterton or whoever it was. This is because we all go around with unmetabolized traumatic experiences that have been all embedded in shame states, and then the false self-critical, self-attacking assessments of I'm no good, or I'm inadequate, or nobody loves me, or the world is no place for me, I don't have a place in the world. And this practice is very effective at helping to challenge those negative beliefs. So if we're talking about reconsolidating those traumatic experiences and beliefs, this is sort of like holding our feet to the fire, or holding our attention to the trauma, where the pain is. And it's the wise part of self-compassion. And explicitly, it's the non-identifying wise part, right? So if you remember RAIN, you go through the recognizing, acknowledging, investigating. So this is what the Buddhists really mean by investigating. This is what they mean. And then when you get to the end and you don't find that you're actually in reality the intrinsically flawed, unlovable, worthless, shameful person that you might feel or might have felt or thought you were at some point, then you can no longer identify with that. And that is really, in my view, the rate limiting step for erasing trauma, for really, really healing trauma. It's very difficult to get to, even in us as caregivers or professionals or contemplatives who spent a lot of time already doing this. So great. There's a lot of great questions. And let me see if I can look at them. And also, let me just keep an eye on the time. Okay. All right. So where are we? Okay, so how long is 1, 2, 3, 4? It also seems spiralic. You might move through it many times in your lifetime and move forward. Yeah, this is not, it's structured as a very analytical, discursive, linear map, but it's not a discursive linear process. It really is an intuitive style of relating to your sense of self, and bringing a kind of reflective, almost therapeutic, dialogical curiosity, you know, about really, am I really, how does that really feel? And what do I really believe about that? And really just relentlessly continuing that conversation. So that's spiralic. It doesn't seem to be linear. Well, the reason why it's not linear is because it is linear, logically speaking, right? We have a premise, which is I have a self that is really me, that is not relative to context, that is fixed over time, that is independent of relationships. This is really me, this is really who I am. We all have that sense. And then we commit to examining it in a binary, linear way. That is, if there is to be, if that intuition that I have, that there's a real me that's fixed and independent, is actually to be true, then I have to be able to find a basis in reality for it, that is a referent in reality. And you know, if I divide the reality into two dichotomous, mutually exclusive and exhaustive categories, the parts of me and what is apart from me, then somewhere in that exhaustive dichotomy, I should find the basis in reality. If I don't find the basis in reality in one half of the dichotomy, and then I don't find it in the other, I have not found a basis in reality for that intuition. And therefore I know that that intuition is a nightmare. It's not a real tarantula. So it is really actually linear. The reason why it feels so nonlinear is because it's going at our sense of identity. And that does, we don't like that. And it's disorienting, and it just, it stirs up resistances and fears and confusion and even panic. So one has to do this, as they say, after you've reached stability in your emotional compassion, including the ability to give compassion to yourself. And yeah, but it is more linear than it seems. But the reason why it feels linear is so nonlinear is because it's completely counterintuitive, is completely standing our common sense experience of ourselves as the most real thing in the world on its head and saying, "Really? Is it really?" It's taking Descartes and saying, "Really, Descartes? You think you, therefore you are? Where do you think? How do you think? Is it in your body? Is it in your mind? You know, where is your mind? You know, how many parts are there to your mind? Is your mind the same in this moment as it was in the last moment? Okay. Is it the same mind or a different mind? Okay. This is this kind of looking at ourself in the way we would look at, you know, strontium or radium or, you know, the movement of the planets, really using our analytical mind. And we normally don't do this. We're just self-protectively designed to not look at ourselves using what some philosophers call our objective self, our ability to step outside our subjectivity and see it from the outside in. Okay, what's interesting about this, okay, can it be done by oneself or with a guide or therapist, an analyst? I would encourage one, it can be done by yourself, but I would encourage it, it's much safer and wiser to do it dialogically. So usually the tradition is just done with a teacher, but it could be done with a therapist by all means. You could say to your therapist, hey, listen, I wanna do this weird kind of self-examination, would you help me? And of course, if they're a Buddhist therapist, theoretically they should understand and be able to help you, although that may not be very, there may not be very many Buddhist therapists who understand this, but they would get the idea for sure. But I think ideally somebody else to help keep you grounded and anchored, and so that you don't feel panicked and you also ideally, they say that the only way to really understand this emptiness, that is to say what we're missing, what we don't have that we think we do have, that's what we mean by emptiness, selflessness. The only way to really understand it is from someone who already has a greater understanding than you do. Like that you actually have to, just reading it is not enough. That you actually have to be in the living, breathing presence or moisture of a person who has lived it in order to really take it in. Otherwise, it just bounces off the conditioning and stays conceptual and doesn't go very deep. Okay, what's interesting about this is it can draw someone not in this tradition to the conclusion that your non-reactivity is somehow non-empathetic. I'm not sure I'm entirely following, Rebecca. If you want to clarify, I think you're saying that.
What I'm briefly saying is like, I feel like the whittling away of reactive responses can obviously, you know, is a goal sort of what we're doing, but at the same time, it can bring about a perception among like communities and collectives that one isn't engaged, or that in fact one is cut off, or one is not in fact feeling in some way for whatever the cause might be, or whatever the, you know, injustice might be, et cetera.
Totally, thank you. Yes, and this can certainly lead to a kind of disengagement, what Ethan warned against as detachment, or getting stuck in detachment, what Bob calls the easy oneness, the cheap oneness, bypassing, whatever you want to call it. This can definitely lead, that is a risk of this. And this is another reason why one has to already have a firm, solid grasp on loving connection to others in order to safely do this and not get lost in space. However, if you'll see as we move on to the next part of our discussion, that this is not seen as an end in itself. And it often is presented as an end in itself. A lot of people present Buddhism as, oh, if you understand and realize selflessness and emptiness, then you're enlightened. Bull, that is completely not so. It is just a gateway to real enlightenment, which is an embodied experience of really healing and transforming your whole way of being and your whole way of seeing and relating to others, in so that you're not a self-enclosed, reactive individual who's coming from a place of fear and alienation, but rather you're a deeply free, internally open and connected person that's coming from a place of confidence and connection. So it is not true that this is an end in itself. It's just a step along the way. It's just an ingredient. And we'll see that as very soon as we look at the grid for how do you actually meditate on this. This is the way into the practice, and then there's a way out of the practice, which is vital to understanding it. So Philip, how could it be incorporated into psychotherapy? The way, as a grid, I don't know. I mean, maybe with some people, conceivably, we could find a way to boil it down into just leading them through it, right? Like, I mean, I think good therapists, when you see the place where your client is stuck in their identification with trauma or shame or shame rage or whatever it is, you need to lead them through that with acceptance to helping them see through that identification and see the other aspects of themselves, the larger dimension of themselves. And so you can guide somebody through this without the structure, just slowly taking them through. And in a sense, in a way, this is kind of like my framework for therapy, because it may take about 5 years or 7 years, but you know, eventually when you really get to what misperception of myself in relation to my caregivers is at the anchor of my suffering and my character defenses, my unhealthy, maladaptive character. There is a misperception down there. And ideally, and when we really do a full analysis, we get to the place where the person can start to see that, oh, because my mother was like this, I started identifying myself as like that. And this is how I fragmented myself and so on and so forth. And that's so we don't have to literally use the grid to help a person vicariously through this process. But it may be a way that we can, you know, do our homework on ourselves or do the experiment in our own minds and bodies. How does awareness fall into the schema? So, well, we need a lot of awareness, self-awareness. It's really about self-awareness, but I'm not sure what you're asking, Max.
A clarifying question, is this the same as the five skandhas?
the five skandhas is, so when you, yes, when you
talk about
parts, step three, you're looking through what is in Sanskrit called the five skandhas or panchaskandhas. I call them the mind-body systems. And it's really, they're just like what's in a person. These five things are in a person. They're just a relatively simple list of what makes a person a person.
Yeah, so I remember learning that a while ago, but I forgot, is awareness part of that, or is like a naked awareness not something we have, like the small self we, but a broader spacious awareness that has the skandhas? And maybe that's referred to as
like, now we're talking philosophy, okay? So you know, and is this is very is, I don't know if we have the time to do this now, but I'll try to do a quick and dirty, and then we'll see if it can, see if it flies.
Thank you.
There are many different theories of self in Buddhist psychology. There are at least four or five main theories of self. And so the most common one that you're alluding to is the one that says that that we don't have an ultimate self, that we don't have a self that's independent, fixed, permanent, partless, but we do have a relative self. And that relative self is the stream of consciousness, okay? And so in that sense, you could look at the whole mind-body process from the perspective of the relative self. And this is even more the case in the idealist schools, like the mind-only or Yogacara schools that Ethan likes. The other system, which is subscribed to by Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Shantideva, Atisha, and Tsongkhapa, is called the dialecticist, or I would say dialogical, consensualist. Well, that's a lot of jargon there. But essentially what it means is their view of the self is that the self is actually not a thing, but is a designation, as a social construction. So they kind of acknowledge this is way back in the second century, in a sense the Buddha acknowledges that the self is a social construction or a psychosocial construction made in dependence or in the context of mind-body systems. So in other words, that shifts the focus from consciousness to language. Right? What they're saying is that actually the self is actually really a constructed category. It's not identical with awareness. Anyway, so that, you know, that gets into a whole nother complicated thing. If you want that analysis, you can look at my translation of Nagarjuna's Reason 60, in which I go into it and relate it to the philosophy of Wittgenstein and Nietzsche and Freud. And that, you know, may be interesting to you. And it is a very subtle, complicated, but it's a very postmodern way of understanding selfhood. And so it's kind of cool in that way. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll look into that.
Awareness. So just to answer your question in a much simpler way, awareness is in the consciousness aggregate. Okay, it is part of consciousness. And it isn't bigger than consciousness. There's not an awareness that's outside the consciousness aggregate, right? There isn't that kind of mystical awareness that's floating out there in the void that holds everything. That's just a meditation practice. That's not a psychological or philosophical reality from a Buddhist point of view.
Okay. Anyway,
I don't want to get too much in the weeds here. So let's go on to, how are we doing time-wise? Okay, so let's go on to the meditation, what do we do after we do this? Supposing we try this experiment, and I encourage you to try it, just while you're here with us as an experiment, right? Because where else are you going to try it? And we can talk about it and see what your experience is. And of course, if you start to get anxious, just stop and follow your breath and we'll talk about it later. But now we get to the point of, so what is supposed to happen after we do this analysis. After we do this analysis, what is supposed to happen is that we've really detached, to use the language of Ethan, from our fixated sense of self. And that means we're kind of like floating out there in outer space without a self to hold on to. Bob talks about this as a dissolution of a sense of self. It's kind of like our computer has just crashed, and the program is crashed, and it's not operating. And this is described as a kind of wisdom that is called the spacious equipoise intuition, right? Akasho Pama Samahita Jnana. And what that means is that they're just describing what this experience is like. If you normally, like, the sense of self is our central processing unit. So if it crashes, we're not able to process anything. And we're in this sort of disoriented fugue state or altered state or dissociated state, which we don't want to stay in, which is not real, any more real than the other states, but is a helpful point of leverage or freedom. It gives us mental flexibility. So when we can enter into that dissolution and learn to tolerate it, right? There's what they call the tolerance of the ungraspability of all things. We learn to tolerate. It's sort of like getting used to, you know, I've had these experiences of waking up from a deep sleep very quickly and not knowing who I am, where I am, or that I am a person, right? You might call that whatever, like a, you know, amnesia, or you might call it a fugue state, or I don't know what you would call it. And I imagine some others of you have had similar kinds of experiences where you have a near-death experiences or other kinds of experiences. And the point is to tolerate those, accept those, and learn how to use them. So how do we use them? Once we're in that detached place, we have space. We have nothing but space, in a way, very little but space. but naturally, of course, the central processor starts to reboot. And pretty soon, our identity is back, our sense of reality is back, our sense of others is back, and everything is all there again, right? So the interesting, and at the same time, while it's all there again, it doesn't feel exactly as real or real in exactly the same way. It has the quality of being a little bit like an illusion. It's not an illusion, okay? The Buddhists are careful, and the Buddha was careful never to say life is an illusion, or our experience is an illusion or a dream. He said it is like that. How is it like it? It's not exactly what it seems to be. It's not unreal. It's just not real in the way it seems to be. So we have this experience where we're back in our lives, but we don't feel the same because we don't feel as separate. And this can then be the basis for cultivating compassion, because now we're actually much more open, now that we've sort of dissolved or temporarily dislodged our fixed sort of centrifuge of focus on ourselves. Our hearts are more open. There's more space to let in our experience of others, and even more other aspects of our experience of ourselves. So while the first mode of wisdom, the spacious wisdom, is considered to be very good for developing wisdom, right? This intuition, the spacious intuition is very good as a basis for wisdom. The aftermath intuition is a very good basis for compassion. And then we're in the process. So to go back to Ethan and Lama Rod says, I want space, but I also want to touch into things, right? So the space is like the detachment. The touching in is like the remembering the relativity and re-engaging, okay? Analytically, in terms of Buddhist meditative psychology, the space is called spacious equipoise intuition. And the touching back into reality after I've had space from it with a fresh perspective and openness is called the illusory aftermath. Okay, And we're still not done with the process. Then we go into this process of oscillating or toggling back and forth. And this can take years or decades. Over and over, toggling back and forth, over and over again, until we are more familiar with and open to our lack of a fixed self, so that it's much closer to our ordinary sense of self. Our self becomes much more transparent. And then when we have a transparent self, it's much more fluid and open to the deeper underlying sense that it's all relative. It depends who I appear to be, depends on who I'm appearing to. And how I can be helpful to them depends on my being open to their experience and flexible for it, right? So this toggling back and forth leads us to an integration or a non-dual awareness or realization or non-dual wisdom that is an integration of wisdom and compassion. So this is kind of like the meditative time machine or apparatus, the central processing unit of this particular practice of cultivating wise compassion. And we can come back to it, but before we do, I wanted to anchor it in the step 2B, right? So how does this relate to the instructions in step 2B? So first, we have to have the preliminaries. We have to grapple with encountering a sense of, being prepared to observe ourselves, right? To learn how to, create the sense of the mindfulness as a foundation, to gather clean data about our experience, and to be able to be open to confronting our experience of traumatic fixation or reactivity. And then we're ready to start practicing the secret of opening up and creating space in there. And so how do we do that? So consider the dreamlike nature of all things. And you can think of that as being like the first and second keys, right? It's like the first key in the sense that the dreamlike nature, we're trying in the first key to reflect on the dreamlike nature of our own traumatic sense of self. We're trying to face like, how real is this? Is it real? What's it like? How does it feel? It's like a dream interpretation. And we're also, this notion of it being dreamlike also implies this question of an epistemic question. I see how it feels, but how real is it? How helpful is it? How realistic is it? So that's where we're covering both steps one and step two, okay? We're both examining the self that's reactive, and we're committing to a way of examining that self deeply or investigating it and analyzing it. Then the third step is this looking amongst our parts for the sense of self, right? And of course, the most important part from a Buddhist point of view, the part that's closest to our subjectivity and our experience is the mind. So essentially what this is saying is like, it's jumping to the chase, getting right to the chase here, cutting to the chase, that even if we look at our mind, we see that there's no self in there, there's no anchor for our sense of identity in mind. Is it our mind even? Is it even mind, right? If we really examine mind carefully, we don't find something we can grab a hold of. It sort of slips through our fingers like sand or like water. So assuming that we've done the third step, we haven't been able to find a solid sense of self in our parts, including our mind. Then we move to the fourth step, which we're looking at what's apart from our parts. So supposing we have this reified sense of detachment, like a spiritual oneness or openness or wisdom or godhood or whatever it is, and we think we're going to find a self in there. And this, and here this precept says, even the remedy of openness itself is objectively free of fixed self or bias, right? So that's the fourth step, okay? So we're not getting attached to the detachment, okay? So then where are we? We're at the foundation of the path. The foundation of the path is our ability to create space from our reified sense of self. So that's what the actuality of the path rests in the fundamental realm of sheer openness. That is the foundation for freeing ourselves up in our own, out of our trauma and into our own healing and compassion, is this capacity to be in openness, to be with openness without fear. Then in between sessions, like after we did the dissolving or the detaching, we re-engage. And we then re-experience ourselves as an illusory person. So the second to last line here describes the spacious equipoise intuition. And the last line describes the illusory aftermath intuition. And all the previous lines describe the four keys, right? So this little beautifully disguised set of seemingly innocuous or whatever verses distills the heart of all Buddhist philosophy in these whatever six lines. It's really profound. So that's that. Any questions about that before we have a few minutes and maybe we haven't made a whole lot of progress, but hopefully this has been helpful. Any questions? All right. So let's just touch on the next points of the mind training, right? Turning adversity to advantage. Once we're able to get space from our traumatized sense of self, then we have the secret elixir to metabolize our own trauma. And when we can metabolize our own trauma, we can go through the world and be a recycler of trauma, right? Because it doesn't stick to us. It doesn't trigger us. We can be around trauma and bring compassion where it's needed. We become the super co-regulators that Stephen was talking about, right? So when the environment is wholly poisoned by vice, if that doesn't sound like descriptive, okay, we turn adversity to the path to collective awakening. In other words, whatever it is, whether it's personal trauma or systemic racial, gender, social trauma, that adversity becomes our path. Now we're able to face it because we know that we're going to be able to tap into our sources of resilience and openness, and we're going to be able to not be triggered by the trauma, and hence we're going to be able to be with it without harm to ourselves and hopefully bringing help to others, right? We apply meditation to whatever comes, whatever eventuality comes, whether things, so this is what we mean. This is the kind of meditation we're applying the meditation of wise compassion, starting on the wisdom of, and the compassion of freeing ourselves from our own bondage. And then that being the reservoir, the mine, the gold mine within us, the jewel mine within us, from which we're mining the precious jewels of love and compassion. And the best method is to practice with the four preparations. Essentially, all they're saying here is get prepared. This is a long path. This is a marathon. This ain't a sprint. And so you need to learn how to build your strengths. You need to learn how to get over your vices or weaknesses. You need to learn how to give and offer and give back, that to build love, as Losong was saying. And you need to learn how to deepen your confidence through connecting with others in a place of compassion, all right? So these are just talking about this process of really making a marathon out of it and preparing to resist the insanity, whether it be our working with the trauma of our clients or friends or family, or working with the collective trauma of our systemic insanity of a culture. So then we look at what does that mean over the course of our life? Since we're committed to a marathon, then what? Well, you've got, if you want to do it, you know, you're going to have to distill the essence of the precepts. In other words, you're going to have to keep going over these precepts and the meaning of them with the five powers. And this is just another way to say, this is going to take a long time, guys or folks. It's going to be, it's going to involve building compassion, effort of practice, nurturing your ability to be positive, being willing to know what you need to get rid of, you know, murdering your darlings, as they say in the writing department, and then building faith and aspiration, aspiring to greater development. And the fact of the matter is that this same teaching, they say, can apply to our aging and death, to thinking about our mortality and preparing for it. So we can prepare for life through these preparations, or we can prepare for death. And they're really the same. So, okay. And I think there's some question. I'm wondering if we can, Jennifer, is this the nature of mind practice? Nature of mind practice is like the spacious equipoise practice, right? And the part of it that's like the illusory aftermath is where you welcome all appearances in your mind as appearances of your mind. This is a slightly different way into that, which is, comes from a slightly different tradition. This will be available, this text, okay? So then we go on to measuring success on the path, okay? So how do we know we're going in the right direction? Okay, how do we want to measure it? Well, this is, as Losung said, this is an experiment. We have to keep checking on ourselves. We have to know if we're making progress, right? How do we do that? If we're heading in the right direction, everything we've ever learned is feeding into our compassionate openness, right? Our wise compassion is growing. We become more and more open and caring as humans. That's one way we know we're making progress. The other is we learn to be able to trust our own experience, our own perception of whether we're crazy in this moment or sane in this moment. So the two witnesses of, again, there's witness here has to do with checks and balances and the reality checks. This is part of the dialogical process. This is an intersubjective science. It's not just, I know I'm enlightened. It's what do you think? I feel I'm enlightened. What do you think? How does it feel to you? There's always a dialogical process here. And so the inner witness is, I have a sense that I'm getting it. I have a sense that I'm in the right place. And the outer witness is other people are saying, yeah, you're doing better. You seem to be kinder. You seem to be more patient. You seem to be more open. You know, you're less of a brat or whatever it is, okay? So in this practice, we know when we can rely more and more on our own witness of our own, whether we're on track or off track, that's a sign of progress. If we tend to be more able to get it right, that, yeah, I was wrong in that situation, or I was right in that situation, or I dealt with that well, or I dealt with it badly, then we know we're making progress as we have more, I guess, observing ego, I guess. And here's, of course, a very challenging but very beautiful, always rely exclusively on the happy mind. Okay, so this is, how do we measure success? How much are we able to feel a sense of access to our well-being? If we can feel a sense of access to well-being, it's not necessarily bypassing. There is real emotional development and human development where we can actually be well, even in the face of terrible suffering and wrong, and find the space to be with it, to be okay with it. And that's also how we know that we're more able to be okay with all of it. And then here's beautiful, the measure of having learned is the elimination of obstacles. There's two kinds of obstacles. If you remember the cycle of dependent origination, the first link is delusion. The second link is destructive emotions. So one kind of block is mental, and that is having self-limiting, reified, unacknowledged biases, assessments, conclusions. In other words, it's a cognitive block. That's one kind of block. My mind can't be open because I'm convinced of something, right? The other is an emotional block. My mind can't be open because I'm too disturbed. I'm too upset, right? So my mind and my heart, in order to be fully open, I have to be able to be unconvinced of everything and to have a really open, free mind without any convictions at all. We'll try that. And then, and you know, and without fear, total curiosity, total awe in a way. And then also to have really equanimity in that process, where I'm not being bounced around by feeling a need to cling to things or be averse to things. And the mark of having learned, if I really can get there, is that I become, as a human, more of a bodhisattva, that is, more magnanimous. And that can come in five flavors, which is not really, it's sort of arbitrary. The five is arbitrary, but just let's suffice it to say there are different flavors of compassionate embodiment, right? There's people who are more in the creative form, or more in the social form, or the spiritual form of altruism. And then this final line, when adept despite distractions, you finally learned, that is when you can't get rattled. So we will come back to this, but I wanted to at least sort of run through the rest of the points that we've touched on and give you a kind of a word, you know, a kind of oral, a spoken take on them. But you see the big picture, which is that the crux of the process is in step two. Everything is happening in point two. Like, I'm building care, my ability to be positive emotions, and that helps me overcome emotional blocks. Then I'm building my capacity to have deep wisdom and openness, and that's building my capacity to overcome mental blocks. And through overcoming, and blocks is one way, or veils or obscurations or coverings, we peel off these layers of trauma and misperception, and eventually we get to the heart of the our being, the natural, the Buddha mind, the natural mind of clarity, of brilliance and compassion, and we can be awake with it, right? And that's, but the whole heart of it is in the second step, and the other ones that we've just touched on are really just, now what do we do? We've got the heart of the practice. Now, how do we stick with it? How do we bring it through our whole lifetime? How do we stick with it for a lifetime? How do we know we're in the right, we're heading in the right direction? Okay. And how do we know when we've gotten somewhere? Because we want to check that we're getting somewhere. So those are really, and if you remember, Anne and Roshana sent around that lovely email summarizing Losang's comments, and he had this notion of an integrated practice, and which had this sense of, like, we're setting goals, we're doing experiments, and we're checking our progress. And that's the spirit here. So we don't have, sadly, time, unless there's a quick question that has to be asked. Thank you, Joyce. And again, we have lots of time to come back to this, and we'll have Ani Samten is going to be a wonderful, I think Ani Samten is next week. Is that right, Roshana?
That's correct.
You're going to love Ani Samten. She is a trip. She's an amazing woman, a very powerful nun in the Buddhist tradition. And then we have a Pilar back, and then we have another class. So we have three more classes to continue to digest this. And again, just for your own practice, I would say the best way to digest it is to just read it over. Read it over once a day for a while. Don't worry about whether you understand it or whether it sticks with you. Just read it over. And gradually it will start to resonate and stick. Okay? All right. Wonderful. See you all next week. Thank you so much.